Hey folks, it's John. Welcome back to another episode of Talk to Me in the Car, a podcast about all things teaching related and education inspired that I literally record right here in my vehicle on my drive back from work as a high school instructional coach. Today, my drive back from work will not be from my high school, which is outside of Washington, D.C. Rather, it'll be from the BWI airport as I'm making my way back from a wall-to-wall conference weekend that took me coast to coast to learn about learning in two very different sectors. We'll talk about that in a second. But first things first, if you like what you're hearing, new podcasts come out every Monday. Feel free to subscribe on your favorite podcasting app. And if you want to leave a rating there, that's awesome. It helps other people find the podcast. Each Monday, the podcast is about 10 to 15 minutes long, depending on how traffic is. And my goal is to start up a conversation, not to end it. So feel free to join the conversation on Twitter. I'm at MeehanEDU. Feel free to message me at any time, and I'll gladly talk to you all week. Or you can head to my website, which is www.adrenalinerush.com. It's adrenaline spelled with an E, like educational adrenaline. I'm fired up about teaching, and I share my templates, resources, and all sorts of blog posts and media there. And I wrote a book called Adrenaline Rush, which is all about game-changing student engagement, inspired by theme parks, mud runs, and escape rooms. So if you want to check that out, that's on the website too. Now, today, I want to talk about learning and games and conference travel. And I have a bonus story. If you stick around to the end of the podcast, I'll try to throw that in too. But I want to talk about two very different conferences that I went to on Friday and then Saturday that took me from Baltimore, Maryland, all the way up to Portland, Oregon. They're very, very different locations, very, very different audiences, and very, very different purposes. But I'm learning through my conference travels that there's like a thread, like a commonality. And I think that that's actually, we have more in common than we think. So let's just get into it. So my teaching schedule works out such that as an instructional coach, I have two sections of American literature. I teach two classes a day, and then I spend the rest of the day working as a teacher coach or teacher trainer, really working with people, all content areas, math, science, English history, religion, world languages, PE, health, specials, electives, you name it. So I joke, even though I'm a Catholic school teacher, that great teaching is content agnostic. So you don't have to be any one discipline to be a great teacher. Rather, we study the science of teaching and the technique of teaching, and we get better and improve our skills. So I do have opportunities to kind of connect and meet with people all through our building. The way our schedule works out for teaching is 3 days a week, typically, we see all seven class periods. And then 2 days a week, we see half the class periods for twice the time, which allows us like to have a block period in there, about 90 minutes, give or take, which we can also use for like our school assemblies or, you know, big programming and things like that too, once a week, because there's a lot of interruptions for like pep rallies or early dismissals or PD days, whatever that looks like. So seven classes a day on Monday, Tuesday, and Friday, usually, and then 2 days a week, half the classes for twice the time, which means if I'm in a classroom, I could be with my kids, and that's amazing. If I'm not in a classroom, I could work with teachers for larger extended blocks. And we find that that can be really helpful because sometimes you just need a little bit more time to kind of dig deep and get, you know, the type of sustained support we can need. Now, as an instructional coach, that might mean working with teachers to do lesson planning or unit planning or new technology, trying to figure out how to do different things with student engagement or introduce them to new platforms from the web, whatever that looks like. And really, it is highly personalized, so you don't really know what your work as an instructional coach will look like on a day-to-day basis. But the way it works out is with my schedule, because I teach just two periods a day, 1 day a week, typically, I have the day off from teaching responsibilities. So if I'm not in my own classroom, I'm working with other teachers to get them ready for things that they're doing. And you really are kind of building the plane as you fly it, so you never really know what that's going to look like. Or if that schedule works out, my school also has it such that I'm able to take that time to travel for conferences or present as related to the book, which has been really great. So I have a chance to kind of be, you know, like an ambassador for our school and for Catholic education and travel to a bunch of different places to talk about the work that we're doing, whether it's with instructional coaching or student engagement, assessment, just learning how to be more student-centered and more human-focused in our instruction here in 2020. Now, all that said, 1 day a week, if I'm at a conference, sometimes I'm talking on behalf of my school, as was the case this Saturday when I was up in Portland, Oregon. Sometimes I'm just out working with other schools as like a consultant or as a speaker or as a trainer on the heels of my book. And that's cool. That's a really awesome benefit that I've had this great blessing to be able to do a little bit of both, both the me stuff and the we stuff. But really, I like to think of it as, again, just the rising tide lifting all ships. And whether it's people who find me because they listen to the podcast or follow me on Twitter or have seen me at other conferences and reach out with me directly, or it's people who know us because our school is inviting teachers in for trainings or inviting teachers in to shadow or hosting big events on weekends like ed camps. It helps get the word out that great teaching is happening and you can come see it and then you can go do it. I think a lot of times when we see speakers, we leave feeling very motivated, but it's hard to know what the next steps of implementation looks like. And I keep hearing that at conferences. People say that their conference experiences are often good but overwhelming because many of the sessions they'll see will consist of a teacher or a team presenting their findings or their research of here's what we have learned. But the teacher team then walks away and says, okay, well, how do I do that in my classroom? They don't always have those answers. So I went to a pair of conferences. On Friday this past week, I was in Baltimore, Maryland for the GBL Summit. That is the Game-Based Learning Summit. It was hosted or sponsored by Legends of Learning, which is a engagement platform for students from 3rd to 8th grade. It has like a gamified element to it. And so it's very, very immediately, very gamer-focused, very game-focused. And it was about 150 people at a hotel in Baltimore. We were at the Four Seasons, la-di-da, right? Very nice. And while we were there, it has a very hard STEM focus, does the Legends of Learning platform. And it focuses younger. So already you can see like a very specific demographic. It's geeky, it's techie. They had a very cool feature where outside of the ballroom area, they had like a game alley where you could just play different games, either set up on high top tables or, small, like little booths. And so people were walking around playing King of Tokyo, which is a Richard Garfield board game. That was there, or Splendor, or Pandemic, right? You have board games there, or Kerplunk, or Don't Break the Ice. But they even set up one or two old school Nintendo, like the Nintendo Classic. And so there were people there mingling with some of the student presenters, because they had about 150 people in all at the conference. And so some student presenters who were in their early teens were there playing Punch Out and the Mario games. And it's like, oh, that's so cool. I think that gaming is really neat because it brings us together, regardless of age, regardless of experience. There's something that's sort of universal about it. And that's awesome. And I think that that's the first thing I wanted to say in the podcast is playful learning really does speak naturally to like people who are in that geek culture. And I'm saying geek with, the kindest heart that I can. We think about gamers, we think about nerds, we think about like Comic-Con, right? There's a big overlap there with that. And especially with a STEM platform that's designed for youngers, it makes sense that young kids who are getting into Minecraft and getting into like Fortnite would naturally bleed over into a classroom technology or an engagement platform like ClassCraft or ClassDojo or Legends of Learning. Because what it's doing is it's speaking the language that they already speak outside of class in that playful experience and creating an interface that makes them want to come back in and do more tomorrow. But instead of like scoring points or scoring kills in video games, they're leveling up their math skills. And how cool is that? So I got to give a keynote and that was amazing. And this is part of the bonus story I'll save to the end of the podcast, but I even got paid a little bit of money. Woo woo, that's cool. I'll talk about that in a second. But then I left there and flew from the Baltimore airport all the way over to Portland, Oregon, where I joined a colleague and we presented on Saturday morning, bright and early, at the Council for Exceptional Children annual conference, which they call the CEC conference. Exceptional Children conference is defined as what often in the room was called one percenters. When I was in school, we might call them students with learning disabilities. Today, we'll talk about it through the language of like learning differences. That could be students who are on the spectrum or students who receive expanded services or like one-on-one mentoring or paraprofessional support. It could also be students who may have moderate to severe intellectual or cognitive delays. It could also be students who are struggling with traumatic brain injuries or concussions, or students who are dealing with social emotional trauma, or students who are LGBT, or students who are living in systemic poverty, generational poverty. And so trying to engage those students who are labeled, quote, exceptional, what we start to see is that's the Big Ten party, right? Like there are actually more exceptional learners than there are traditional learners, which is a big, big difference than the conversation I was in the day before, which is, okay, we're going to go deep into geek. And, like the people who speak the language of video game. But then at this next presentation, we're talking about reaching kids who feel left out, feel marginalized, feel forgotten by a traditional school system. And yes, it's true that, geek and nerd culture for a very long time was sort of on the fringes of cool, like your typical Dungeons and Dragons kid. But we're talking about kids who didn't choose to be a geek or choose to be a gamer or choose to be a nerd or choose to, like, get involved with a Dungeons & Dragons or a chess club. We're talking about students who, through no volition of their own, are just born into situations whereby the traditional learner profile and them aren't on the same page. And how do we reach those students in our courses, in our classrooms? Because I can design something that feels very geeky, very nerdy, and very cool to a gamer type, but to a student who has been systemically marginalized or who's receiving, you know, one-on-one mentoring support because of, you know, moderate to severe intellectual delay, it's hard to create a system whereby all students in the classroom are receiving, quote, equal access to the curriculum. And what was interesting is when we gave our presentation, my colleague and I, we talked about the power of playful learning and a lot of game-based learning to make it happen so that even if you are receiving expanded services or support from a paraprofessional, students tend to speak the language of game pretty innately because they grow up playing games. Maybe the games are more or less complicated, games like Candyland or, you know, are very, very different than games like Clue or Monopoly. Games like Risk are certainly much harder and much more nuanced and advanced than games like Chutes and Ladders or Mousetrap. But the principles are the same. It's about turn-taking. It's about rules. It's about, quote, teaching to mastery, that if you get it right, there's a success outcome, and if you get it wrong, you go back a space or you have to do it again. And you learn very quickly that through the social-emotional acclimation, different students learn in different ways on different days. And what's so beautiful about gaming and play is it really does bring everyone to the table to sit down. If you're a parent yourself, you've been able to sit with your own kids and just play a board game. And even though you are advanced in your age or advanced in your experience, there's still a chance in that game that they might beat you. If it's a game of luck or a game of, you know, moderate skill. If it's a game of strategy, you might have an advantage on them, but there's still these chaos moments at any moment that a student can get back in the game. You know, I talk about Mario Kart. Students can beat me consistently in games like Mario Kart because they're very, very skilled. But when you're falling behind in a game like that, the game itself sort of helps you out, gives you these power-ups to get you back in the game so that you never really feel out of it. And what it's doing on a teaching side of things is scaffolding on the fly. It's creating a rubber band mechanic to kind of get you back in. And that's what a good classroom does, so that everyone is finishing at about the same time. The races are always competitive and close. And if you're designing a classroom with that in mind, if you have a student who receives expanded services, maybe they're only at like level 5 of the game. Meanwhile, across the way, you might have a student who's talented and gifted, but that student might be at like level 27 of the game. But if you're designed your course right, it doesn't matter whether you're being asked level 5 questions or level 27 questions, the reward for correct answers is always a harder question. So once you've competed at level 5, you level up to level 6 questions, and then right next to you, someone else might be taking the exact same text or the exact same course content and just looking at it through a different angle. So maybe if you're studying stuff like the Holocaust, which is a very serious topic, one student might just be doing like a basic recap of what they're learning from a primary source article about from News ELA. Here's the summary of what the Holocaust is or where it was. And maybe they're writing down the main points or the main ideas of where it happened, when it happened, who was involved. On the other side of the same exact classroom, using the Holocaust as our case study, someone could be using a thing like Minecraft and designing the annex where Anne Frank and her family spent all those years in hiding. But they have to build it to scale using evidence from Anne Frank's diary. So the same class, you know, quote, Holocaust studies, is doing very different things. It's like Montessori school. And then each student, when they're delivering that work product, should be able to account for, does it meet the standard or does it not? If it does not, they have to go back and do it again. And what we find, especially with exceptional learners, students who are on the spectrum make very strong, very clear rules about right and wrong. And if it's right, you get to move forward. If it's not right, you do it again. That's not because I'm being mean as a teacher. It's because the game, quote unquote, has very clear metrics for success. And things like that are easy to understand for students because they've been doing it as children from the first games they were playing, whether it's Candyland, Monopoly, or Clue, right? You roll the dice and you move X number of spaces. If you land on it and says go to jail, you're not being mean. That's just the rule of the game. They have to move the piece accordingly. And likewise, they're getting that practice of working around a table with people who have different abilities or skill levels. But they're having a chance to be a human and talk to those people, which allows everyone to recognize that there's a human element that play sort of brings everyone together. I had the chance on the way back home to pop in for a podcast while I was at the airport with my good friend Michael Matera, who hosts the Well Played podcast every Tuesday, and he wrote the Greek book, Explore Like a Pirate. And Michael and I just talked a whole episode, it'll be out I think this Tuesday, about game-based learning and how games really are for everyone, rated E for everyone, right? You know, old and young, rich and poor, black and white, gay and straight, you know, intellectually advanced and, you know, with cognitive delay. There's no Pokemon achievement gap. There's something about that, quote, game that everyone can get into, and there's no distinction between the amount of stuff that people know about Pokemon based on their gender or their race or amount of money that they have access to. They've completed a very, you know, advanced taxonomy of knowledge of all these characters and how they fit and how they evolve and how they morph and how they change. And that has nothing to do with whether they're affluent or whether they're, you know, differently abled. And I think that's a really cool thing. So how do we design our classrooms so that we can do the periodic table the same way? If that makes any sense. All right, bonus story, since you stuck around this long. Thank you for the long podcast this week. I want to talk about teachers who are presenters, because if you've ever been to a conference, you probably see these presenters roll in and you're like, wow, that guy's making bank, he's cleaning up, or she's doing so great, she was here and now she's across the country. And I want to share with you that as a keynote speaker, real talk, in this first session on Friday, I was offered like an honorarium to speak. Not a lot of money, but a little bit. And it's like, woo, woo, get paid. Yes, hooray. Gave my presentation. I thought I did really well. And I was so proud of myself. I hung out at the conference in Baltimore because I knew I had a flight later that day to Oregon. Now, the Oregon stuff was work-related for my job at my school, so I knew I didn't have to pay for my stay there, my lodging there. But it's nice to make a little bit of money because it takes some time to give that presentation, to develop those materials, to then take time away from your own students. So I sold a few books afterwards, and I gave my presentation, and I walked away like, okay, I got some bucks in my pocket. I'm feeling great. Got to the airport, ready to fly out from Baltimore Airport, only to discover that when I had purchased my tickets, I purchased them from the IAD airport, which is not Indiana, it's the Dulles airport, which is about an hour and a half south of Baltimore. That's not at all where I was, and that makes it really hard to make that 4 p.m. flight if I'm there at 3 o'clock, only to find out I'm an hour and a half away from where I'm supposed to be. So I had to buy a new ticket, and as I bought that new ticket, suddenly that honorarium was like cut in half with the amount of money it took me to fly across the country with late notice on a different airline. Then I got to that new place, gave my great presentation and in Oregon, brought a few books with me and sold out, woo, 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 right, feeling great. So I have a little bit more money in my pocket, feeling good, and then on my way home, I realized that Delta would not honor the return flight at 5:30 in the morning because I had missed the outbound flight, and so they canceled the whole thing without telling me. So every one of those dollars that I made, which had already been cut in half, was then completely eradicated by virtue of the fact that I had to buy yet another ticket one way to fly home from coast to coast. So gotta stay humble at all times, but lest you think that speakers are swimming in it, I think if I did the math properly, I'm out a grand total of maybe $32 for the privilege of being in two different places. And I think that's funny, because, you know, in my head, it's, oh, that guy presented, he must be killing it, they must have it all figured out. I think it's important that we recognize that everybody's making up as we go, and the curated version of what you see on social media is not always the full story. So, anyways, that's it for that. Thanks for tuning in, thanks for listening, I hope you enjoyed today's podcast. A little bit different than our traditional deep dive on one issue, and a little longer, too, so I do appreciate your flexibility on that. If you stuck around this long, I appreciate it, and I look forward to talking with you next time. Thanks again. See you Monday.